Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
We welcome you again to our program, Past Impressions, on the Mormon Channel of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, the chair of the Department of Church History and Doctrine at Brigham Young University, and I've been asked to be your host of this program where we look at the people, places, events, and key issues associated with church history. We're honored today to have again as our guest Professor Robert L. Millett, Professor of Ancient Scripture at Brigham Young University, former Dean of the College of Religious Education, and a prominent author who has written much on the doctrines of the Restoration and on the Prophet Joseph Smith. In our last episode, we talked a little bit about the revelations that were given in Nauvoo that we find in the Doctrine and Covenants. And Bob, in the last episode, I think it's important that we maybe bring our listeners that weren't able to listen to that last episode up to speed, that we talked about Joseph and as a mature revelator in the 1840s, and that it's not so much always just the dictating of revelations that we have in the 1830s, but that it's still mature and deep doctrine. And so we talked in our last episode about the revelations that we received that are in print form, that are in the Doctrine and Covenants, but there were more revelations being received, but they come in the form of sermons and letters and teachings and instructions. Why don't you talk about this idea of the maturing of the Prophet Joseph Smith?
I think it's critical to appreciate that Joseph Smith is assuming a slightly different role. He doesn't seem to be dictating nearly as many revelations. He certainly doesn't seem to be using the Urim and Thummim to receive revelations like he did in New York and Pennsylvania. But it's almost a Nauvoo as if he's become a walking Urim and Thummim.
That's an interesting concept.
He stands and speaks and preaches and teaches, and scribes, be it Wilford Woodruff or Willard Richards or William Clayton, are just writing like crazy and trying to get everything down. And so what you have is you have a mature prophet who is in the midst of his people, much like Moses was in the midst of his people, blessing lives on what we'd call very informal occasions, perhaps, where he speaks and those words are recorded and we now have them either as we indicated last time in the Doctrine and Covenants, or we have them given in the history of the Church.
Mm-hmm. Now, you shared with me, and I really think it's a wonderful statement of this expansive view of the Prophet Joseph that even came in Liberty Jail. You had a wonderful statement of Joseph's view, even while he's in this terrible dungeon, that helps him to feel the depth of God's hand upon him and what he has for the Latter-day Saints. Why don't you share that with us?
You know, this is given from Liberty Jail. It's not something that most of us have heard. In a letter, the prophet wrote the following: "Hell may pour forth its rage like the burning lava of Mount Vesuvius."
And that's what he's in the midst of.
That is right. "Or of Etna, or of the most terrible of the burning mountains, and yet shall Mormonism stand. Water, fire, truth, and God are all realities." And then listen to this power: "Truth is Mormonism. God is the author of it. He is our shield. It is by him we received our birth. It is by his voice that we were called to a dispensation of his gospel in the beginning of the fullness of times. It was by him we received the Book of Mormon, and it is by him that we remain unto this day, and by him we shall remain, if it shall be for our glory. And in his almighty name, we are determined to endure tribulation as good soldiers unto the end." Mm-hmm. It's a powerful statement. I really think there's something remarkable that happens to Joseph in those dark months of seclusion of pain, of frustration, the anxiety he must have felt for his people in Missouri, then later in Illinois, when he wants so desperately to be at their head, but all he can do is communicate by letter. Mm-hmm. And I think it as it so often does, it drives people to their spiritual extremity. And in this case, I think it brings about a major maturation of the prophet's soul so that when he comes out, he is a walking, talking being of light.
That's a great explanation and description. And so as the prophet Joseph emerges onto the Illinois scene after coming out of Liberty Jail, with that spiritual maturity, we don't have a lot of revelations like we have in the Doctrine and Covenants from New York and Ohio, but we probably have more profound doctrinal teachings during that period in the form of sermons that we have recorded. How are they what role do they play in the development of Latter-day Saint theology and the doctrinal teachings that we hold so dear today?
You know, President Hinckley was often asked about how he, as a prophet, because President Hinckley so often opened himself to the media, mm-hmm. to the press, they would occasionally say, "You're a prophet. What does that mean? Do you receive revelations? What is it like?" And you recall that he often referred to the experience of Elijah and the still small voice. But on more than one occasion, he said something like this. He said, "You know, we have a great backlog of revelations, mm-hmm. most of which were received," he said, "by the prophet Joseph Smith, and represent," he went on to say, "a kind of foundation upon which we build and the basis for which we make many of our decisions." I think it's important, Brent, first to remember that Joseph Smith was a prophet, but he was more than a prophet. He was a prophet's prophet. Mm-hmm. As a dispensation head, he becomes what I've often called the preeminent prophetic revealer of Christ and the plan of salvation. So that it's appropriate in a testimony meeting for somebody to stand and bear testimony of Christ in one breath and bear testimony of Joseph Smith, the preeminent revealer of Christ, mm-hmm. almost in the same breath, because to bear testimony of Joseph Smith is to bear testimony of Christ.
We probably have no more rich period of teaching of the saints than what Joseph does in Nauvoo, in formal settings and less formal settings. Why don't we talk about some of your favorite or what you would consider to be the most significant of those doctrinal discourses that Joseph gave in Nauvoo?
You know, to begin, Brent, I'm looking at the history of the church about October 1840. There's just something called Remarks on Priesthood, and Joseph stands and speaks on this. Now, keep in mind, putting this in context, October 1840, he had given his first remarks on baptism for the dead on the 15th of August, 1840, and now it's just a short time after that, and Joseph's talking about such things as the priesthood as a great channel of revelation. Notice we get this line, which I don't suppose there's been a general conference that I haven't heard this quoted for a long time. The brethren quote this so often. "It is the grand head and holds the highest authority which pertains to the priesthood and the keys of the kingdom of God in all ages. It is the channel through which all knowledge, doctrine, the plan of salvation, and every important matter is revealed from heaven." And he goes on and talks about it being from the foundations of the world. He talks about Adam as the first man, the Ancient of Days, but he also talks about Adam holding the keys of all the dispensations. Mm-hmm. He begins to in other words, during this particular sermon, he sets up some principles of priesthood government that guide us today in knowing some things about not only about our day, but about the past. It was Joseph McConkie that got me thinking about something years ago. He said, "Joseph Smith may well have revealed more about the past than he has about the present or the future." Mm. And I think that's right. Mm-hmm. I think when I look at it, there's so many things we come to know about the past. And knowing those things, we can understand how things operated then and how they ought to operate now. Mm-hmm. If a person says, for example, "Well, I'm not sure that we don't have any evidence that Nephi was baptized." Well, he was a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And Joseph Smith said all the prophets had the Melchizedek priesthood, and I would suppose the Lord would want you baptized before you get the mm-hmm. Melchizedek priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
And now how do we know that? Because of the sermons the prophet gave on the order of priesthood government. It's during the same section that he talks about, and I love this, the ordinances being forever the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that Adam participated in them, that Abel participated in them, that Paul participated in them. And their antiquity is significant. And in contradistinction to what other Christian groups might feel, the Lord has revealed that they're to be performed in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Something like baptism is not to be altered.
And so the church, the covenants, the principles have been the same and are based on those eternal laws and eternal principles.
Yep.
Let's talk about other sermons that jump out at you from this Nauvoo period as well.
Joseph begins to talk more and more and more about baptism for the dead. Let me read you a few words from him. He says, "I presume the doctrine of baptism for the dead has before this, reached your ears and may have raised some inquiries in your minds respecting the same." He goes on to say, "I first mentioned this doctrine in public when preaching the funeral sermon of Brother Seymour Brunson." That was back mm-hmm. on that 15 August 1840. And so he talks about baptism for the dead. Moving again into October 1840, he talks about different degrees of the Melchizedek priesthood. This is where he says, for example, all priesthood is Melchizedek, but there are different portions or degrees of it. That portion which brought Moses to speak with God face to face was taken away, but that which brought the ministry of angels remained. And then he says, all the prophets had the Melchizedek priesthood mm-hmm. and were ordained by God himself. You see, Brent, that says something about, let's take the days of Lehi. Here you have Jerusalem under siege to the Babylonians. Now, what is Lehi's relationship to the prophets in the community? I mean, he has contemporaries like Jeremiah, mm-hmm. probably Ezekiel and Daniel, Habakkuk, Zephaniah. And the question is, do we suppose they're just sort of out there on their own preaching, prophesying, etc.? Knowing what we know about how God operates and that his house is a house of order, all revealed by Joseph Smith, we would suppose that there was someone who held keys
mm-hmm.
and that somebody's in charge and that Lehi would have answered to someone,
mm-hmm.
at least until he left on his journey to the New World. And so these kinds of things Joseph begins to unfold.
Today on Past Impressions, we're talking with Professor Robert L. Millett of Brigham Young University about some of the great doctrinal discourses and sermons given by the prophet Joseph Smith in Nauvoo. We talked about funeral sermons particularly, where we have some of the choicest doctrinal teachings. We mentioned Seymour Brunson and the concept of baptism for the dead and then great discussions about priesthood. Let's talk about some of these others. Perhaps James Adams is an example of great doctrine that comes out of a funeral.
Yeah, that is one of my favorites, Brent. Again, we're in October of 1843 here, and the prophet in that sermon, he says this. He said, "All men know they must die, and it is important that we should understand the reasons and causes of our exposure to the vicissitudes of life and death and the designs and purposes of God in our coming into the world, our sufferings here, and our departure hence. It is but reasonable to suppose that God would reveal something in reference to the matter." And he goes on and says it's something we ought to study as much as anything else.
He says day and night we ought to study it. Yeah.
And it's in this sermon that the prophet says, if a man could gaze into heaven 5 minutes, he would know more than you would by reading all that's ever been written on the subject of life after
mm-hmm.
death. And again, there was a cute story that I heard back in Louisiana. A teacher that I knew had read this sermon, and he came to class that next Sunday, and he read that to them, and he said, "So, brothers and sisters, I'm going to ask you to to go out into your backyards each night and look up into the sky. And I promise you, you're going to learn more from that than, well, that I suppose that's a valuable meditative experience, but Joseph's
not quite what Joseph
not
had
quite.
In mind.
I think he's saying you penetrate the veil and you're going to learn a whole bunch faster.
Yeah.
But it's in this great sermon that Joseph begins talking about angels and spirits. Something like this: spirits can only be revealed in flaming fire and glory. Mm-hmm. Angels have advanced further, mm-hmm. meaning they're resurrected.
And the spirits of just men are not far from us.
Well, here's the line. Brother Adams has gone to open up a more effectual door for the dead. The spirits of the just are exalted to a greater and more glorious work. Hence, they are blessed in their departure to the world of spirits. Enveloped in flaming fire, they are not far from us, and know and understand our thoughts, feelings, and motions. And this part is a little haunting. And are often pained therewith.
Yeah.
So I think this is a terrific sermon. You know, we only have in the history of the church a portion of it, but it must have been a remarkable one. I was thinking of another one, Brent, if I may jump back and
sure.
forth.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of one where he talked about the death of a child.
Yeah, that's. I've been thinking the same thing.
I was thinking that as he gives to us what is just like silver and gold doctrinally, he says, as concerning the resurrection, I will merely say that all men will come from the grave as they lie down.
Mm-hmm.
Whether old or young, they will not be added unto their stature one cubit, neither taken from it. And notice this, all will be raised by the power of God, having spirit in their bodies and not blood. Children will be enthroned in the presence of God and the Lamb with bodies of the same stature that they had on earth, having been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb. They will there enjoy the fullness of that light, glory, and intelligence which is prepared in the celestial kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Setting forth the idea that as Joseph did on more than one occasion, that faithful parents may raise a child that's been lost who died before the time of accountability.
Yeah. And in funeral sermons of children, he would also comment about the little children that are taken before their time were more pure.
That's right.
And more pure. And so oftentimes the quotes that we hear that teach the great comforting doctrines of the restoration were actually given to real people suffering losses in their own lives during these Nauvoo years.
Yes, the prophet talking again and again about sacred things. He continues talking in sermons about baptism for the dead. As we said last, one of our former sessions, the subject became a righteous obsession for the mm-hmm. prophet, linked with the temple. He wanted to get that temple
mm-hmm.
built. It's as if so much depended upon it.
And so discourses that address temple matters as well, we see coming out of those Nauvoo period as well.
That is right. I mean, I was thinking, for example, the prophet's statement about why God builds temples, has temples built to begin with. You know, he says that we build them. How did he put it? He said the main object was to build unto the Lord a house whereby he could reveal unto his people the ordinances of his house and the glories of his kingdom, and teach the people the way of salvation. For there are certain ordinances and principles that, when they are taught and practiced, must be done in a place or house built for that purpose. It's his concept that the final phase, the final stage of gathering, is gathering to the house of the Lord.
Yeah.
And so he begins now to put things in place. He begins with that first vision experience, and now as he's moving toward his death, he's placing the temple in its proper order and putting the saints in a way that they can go to the temple and complete the final phase of gathering.
That leads us naturally to probably the most famous of all of his sermons, and that's what is called the King Follett Discourse or the King Follett Sermon. Why don't you give us a little of the history of how this doctrinal sermon comes about, and then also what is really new in this great doctrinal discourse and what is building upon that which had already been received in the years previous?
I think we're to understand that Brother King Follett, a member of the Nauvoo community, had been killed while he was digging a well. And the prophet takes occasion to pay tribute to him on April 7th, 1844. It's a time where many, many saints came. It's hard to tell how many were there. Some have estimated around perhaps 9,000-10,000 people. It's worth noting that this sermon, we're told in a number of journals that it took about 2 hours to deliver. Hmm. Now, you and I can read it in the history of the church, I think, in about 30 or 40 minutes. Hmm. So clearly, we don't have the whole story here. We don't have everything. Some things are just not contained in the accounts that were written down by Wilford Woodruff and James Mulholland and Willard Richards and William Clayton and so forth. And so it's a special occasion. The prophet seems to be, in a sense, at his best. But it's a little different than if you try to compare this with a sermon at a general conference today. Mm-hmm. There's quite mm-hmm. a difference. This is, in a sense, a little bit more playful. Joseph is being kind of playful with the critics of the church, the enemies of the church, kind of taking on the academically learned ones and saying to them, God has revealed some things to me he hasn't revealed to you. Mm-hmm. And so forth. So it's a little different than what you'd call a typical sermon today. But it is a powerful one, and it sets forth some things that many, many people outside the church use as the grand denunciation of Mormonism. They'll just say, okay, if you need one thing, King Follett discourse. Mm-hmm. And so talking about what's here becomes important. Joseph begins by just saying, what kind of a person is God? And I think one of the great one-liners in this whole sermon is, if men do not comprehend the character of God, they do not comprehend mm-hmm. themselves. That's a magnificent piece of writing. If we don't know what God's like, we'll never completely know what we're like. And that's why the doctrine of man's existence and God's existence are so very eternally linked.
Mm-hmm. You know, certainly that introduction links us back to section 93, where the Lord tells us that he's giving us this revelation that we might know who we worship and why we worship.
And what we worship.
Yeah, and so this whole concept of we cannot truly worship God without understanding the nature of God as well.
Yeah. Joseph begins to ask questions such as, who is God? What do we know about him? He says, God himself was once as we are now and is an exalted man and sits enthroned in yonder heavens. Now, perhaps we'll talk about that in a few moments as far as what we know and what we don't know. But let's just say that clearly Joseph Smith and the saints knew by now that God was a man, mm-hmm. an exalted, glorified man. He's, as we have it in the book of Moses and the JST, a man of holiness. So that idea is not new. But he goes on to talk about God dwelling on an earth before. The fact is, beyond this King Follett discourse, I don't know that we know anything beyond that. I don't know what is it that we could know beyond that about God's mortal existence.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not sure that's exactly what Joseph is trying to say to us anyway. Now, this is just my opinion, but I really think that we need to read that in the broader context of other things where he's teaching the eternal nature of the plan of salvation.
And trying to say he is not just a formless
exactly.
essence out
right.
there, a congeries of laws. No, this is a person who has form and mm-hmm. substance and is a being. And I think that is what made Mormonism so very distinctive and still does.
And I think he's saying that if we as mortals want to have salvation and become like unto God, then we abide by the same principles that God abides, and that we are going to live by those laws that are from eternity to all eternity.
Right. The prophet takes the first line of the Hebrew Bible, Bereshit bara Elohim, God in the beginning, God created, and he plays upon that. He had learned some Hebrew in the school of the prophets, and as had a number of the brethren. And it seems to me, Brent, that what Joseph is doing here is not teaching us Hebrew. Mm-hmm. He's teaching us doctrine, and he's trying to say, almost like the rabbis used to do with Scripture,
mm-hmm.
a kind of a doctrinal midrash,
mm-hmm.
where he's saying, "Why, look, isn't it fascinating that the word Rosh is used, head, the head of the gods brought forth the gods and so forth, the council of the gods, mm-hmm. as we call them. In the beginning, the head of the gods called a council of the gods, and they came together and concocted a plan to create the world and people it." And he goes on and talks about, and I think this is a very important contribution of this discourse, the meaning of the word create, and that it means to form, not to make of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this is a denunciation of the Platonic Christian belief of ex nihilo creation, that God created everything out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We know that that had been around, that idea, among the saints as early as section 93.
Correct.
So
mm-hmm.
when the Lord essentially teaches that the elements are eternal.
Mm-hmm.
And they're there. They've been there forever. And so the prophet then goes on in a beautiful section to talk about the immortal spirit, that the mind of man is immortal and that it had no beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that harks back to section 93. We've been told that intelligence had no beginning and will have no end. We say that God himself is a self-existent being. Who told you so? It is correct enough, but how did you get it into your heads? Who told you that man did not exist in like manner upon the same principles? I think that's one of the great contributions of this sermon. The relationship of man to God, and that God can give revelation to the spirit of man independent, as it were, of the physical body,
mm-hmm.
as though man didn't have a body at all. It's in the midst of this that the prophet goes back to
which is not new doctrine either.
No.
We go back, clear back to even before the church is organized, section 8, the
That's
spirit
right.
of revelation.
That's right.
The Lord tells us that. So.
He's just telling us more about it.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest responsibility we have is to save our dead.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the midst of all this, he talks more about baptism for the dead. Talks about the unpardonable sin, about the fact that some people who have received a terrific amount of light and understanding, how does he say? He says, what must a man do to commit the unpardonable sin? He must see that the sun is shining and say that it does not shine. He has to know God and then sin against him. So
yeah,
we're talking about a tremendous amount of light and knowledge.
Yeah, fight against him.
And know, then and deny and defy,
mm-hmm.
deny and defy. I suppose, Brent, that the most significant thing Joseph talks about for our purposes is to affirm what had been taught earlier, that man and woman can, through the atonement, through the powers of the priesthood, come eventually to be as God, that man has the capacity to grow in spiritual graces and spiritual gifts, to come to gain the character, the qualities, the attributes of God. We will never take over God's position. We will never oust or unseat our Heavenly Father or His Son.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is we have no indication in anything in Mormonism, any of our literature, that we'll ever worship anybody but the gods we worship now.
Why don't you address what President Hinckley said about some of the controversy or the questions concerning this sermon and what some of our critics say about this?
As I recall, President Hinckley was asked about man becoming as God, and his comment was, and about God being man. And President Hinckley's comment more than once was with the media was, I'm aware of that sermon. I'm aware of the circumstances under which it was given. I think I understand the setting. But, he said, I haven't heard that talked about and discoursed on in a long time. And I don't know a great deal about those subjects. And I don't know anybody who does.
Mm, interesting.
And I don't think that's a way of dodging media as much as it is saying we're aware of a concept that's taught in our scriptures and, frankly, that's taught in the New Testament, that man can become like God.
Mm.
Beyond that, beyond what the revelations have taught us, we just don't know. And so I see this as one of the great, great illustrations of the prophet feeling free in Nauvoo to just stretch his mind and stretch his soul and say to the saints, come, look, let's gaze upon the scenes of eternity. And what are the eternal human possibilities?
Yeah. I just think we ought to close this episode by also saying that the discourses not only give us great doctrinal insight, but they also give us the they give us the notion or the confirm our testimony of Joseph Smith as a revealer. When in that great discourse, the King Follett, where he talks to the saints and he says, "What manner of man is God? Have you seen him? Have you heard him?" I always love that, is it's a way of saying, I have.
I have.
I have. And, you know, as we close, as we've talked about these doctrinal discourses, I think it's good for our listeners to know that almost all of them, but, you know, the vast majority of any statement that we hear of attributed to the prophet Joseph Smith on great doctrinal matters, the great majority of those were given in Nauvoo.
Yeah.
And Nauvoo was a period of great doctrinal foundation
for the church. It's the foundation of our doctrine today.
Thank you, Dr. Robert L. Millett. And we hope that you will listen to future episodes of Past Impressions, where we study the history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm Brent Topp, your host, saying goodbye.